And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I absolutely love that recording of When You Wish Upon a Star, and I am very much an admirer of the singer. His name is Bill Hayes, a very familiar name, I'm sure, to many of you. I suspect a very familiar voice to many of you as well. Bill Hayes, who originally hailed from the good old Midwest, and we'll talk about that, ultimately has had a very interesting, varied, rich career, including a stint on your show of shows with the legendary Sid Caesar, as one of the leads in a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical on Broadway as it opened, Me and Juliet, and the number one Billboard song in all of America, The Ballad of Davy Crockett at one point, and then a long stint on one of the most beloved of soap operas, Days of Our Lives. And joining him on that show for many, many years, his real-life wife and screen wife as well, Susan Seaforth Hayes. I am a friend of the niece of Bill Hayes, Joanne Hayes Bozeman, who is a highly regarded voice teacher at Lawrence College in Appleton, Wisconsin. And Joanne and her husband, Ken, have endowed a new award as part of the musical theater competition for Nats, and it will bear the name of her beloved uncle, Bill Hayes. And that's really the occasion for this conversation, in which we're going to talk with Bill Hayes about the many facets of his career, but especially talking about his career as one of the finest vocalists of his generation. Bill Hayes, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Hi, folks.
Really happy to be talking with you, and this is a real delight for me. I actually want to begin with the beginning. That is the fact that you were born in a community called Harvey, Illinois. Ahead of this interview, I meant to get out a map and find out where in the world Harvey, Illinois is. Tell us about Harvey, Illinois.
It's a south suburb of Chicago. If you go due south from Chicago, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm on 150th Street or 155th Street. That's Harvey.
Ah, so you sort of feel like you're from Chicago, or do you like to say you're from Harvey?
Well, either one. I mean, Chicago was the big city, and Harvey was a tiny suburb. It's fine with me either way.
So tell us about your childhood there. What kind of home did you grow up in Harvey, Illinois?
A musical home. My dad was a businessman, sold World Book Encyclopedia, and he loved to sing. He sang every day of his life. So I grew up, I have two brothers, and he used to wake us up in the morning by singing a song. That was his thing. And
was it the same song every day, or it would change?
No, it changed. Well, usually it would be, "Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning." But my brother George, my older brother, played trombone. He and my younger brother Phil and I, with my dad, were a quartet before our voices changed. We used to sing. Harmonize, you know, and then I sang in school choirs and sang in church choirs, and there's a lot of music. as I grew up.
Very good.
I played fiddle in the high school orchestra. I played pretty good fiddle for a while there.
Huh. Was your father a trained singer or just someone who loved to sing and had a lot of natural talent and just happened to do it well?
Sort of both. He had a few voice lessons, and he had a wonderful voice. It was kind of like a John Charles Thomas or a Robert Merrill-type lusty baritone sound.
Wow.
And it was he really had a beautiful voice and did a lot of singing around Harvey. It was always just for fun.
Hmm.
I don't know if he ever got paid for singing, but he sure loved it.
Hmm. I assume you sang as a young boy, kind of a boy soprano with an unchanged voice. What's your recollection of when your voice changed, as all boys' voices ultimately do?
Yes, age 14. I always wanted, I watched my dad sing in the church choir at the Federated Church in Harvey, and I just couldn't wait till my voice changed that I could join in and sing with him. And that my voice changed at age 14, and I went in the tenor section and loved it.
Mm. At what point did you ever take what we would think of as a proper professional voice lesson? Did that ever happen for you during your time in Harvey, aside from school?
Not in Harvey, no. I graduated from high school there and then went to DePauw University in Greencastle, Indiana. There, I took a few voice lessons in my freshman year, and I rather screeched as a tenor. Most of my best singing at that point was blending.
Hmm.
I sang in the university choir, which was oohs and ahs and soft and blending sounds. I sang in a quartet, barbershop quartet, always blended. I did not study voice too much, but I guess hearing my dad and having some of his recordings in my ear, he had some pretty nice recordings, not of himself, but of professional singers. So I listened to those.
So you had some very good influences that sort of, in a sense, helped shape you on top of whatever your natural inclination and talent was.
That's correct.
Mm.
And, then we had World War II, and I sang in a quartet during World War II. I was in the Navy Air Corps. And afterwards, I went back to DePauw, finished up at DePauw, and graduated there. And then I fell into my first professional singing job, and I had still this kind of soft blending sound, which pretty much you heard on that recording that you just played. After that, I got in the singing chorus of Carousel when it arrived in Chicago on its national tour, and the fellas in the show kept telling me, "Look, if you want to sing in theater, you have to learn to project. You have to take some voice lessons here. You have to develop a different sound from this soft blending sound. That will never reach the front row, let alone the back row."
I want to stop you for just a second. So, for instance, then back in high school, were you in a school that ever did, for instance, musicals? I mean, and were you ever the lead?
Yes, or were I did some. And at DePauw, I sang some Gilbert and Sullivan, the Gondoliers, and Pirates of Penzance, and things like that. I could project some, but they really had a point that I needed to develop more of a robust sound to carry in a theater. Because at that time, now we have all kind of manner of microphones. Then there were not. Those were not available.
Right. By the way, tell us more about this matter of Carousel. I had read in one of the biographies of you that Carousel had some impact on you in terms of getting you really on the track to becoming a full-fledged professional singer. But I hadn't realized that that carousel experience actually involved you singing in the chorus. Tell us more about how that happened.
Well, as I said, my it started with my father's fun. He was this businessman, and that was his real job. What he did for fun was sing and act, and I thought that's the way it was. I had no idea you could make a living, get paid for doing what you enjoyed. When I got out of college, my young brother Phil had written to the stage manager of Carousel saying, if you need a tenor replacement, I'd like to audition for you. And I arrived home just as he received a postcard saying, yes, come to the Schubert Theater, stage door, 2:00 Tuesday, and prepared to sing a song. Well, he had a strep throat. He could not make a sound. So I scratched Phil off, and I put Bill on the card, and I went down to the Schubert Theater, and I sang for them. I sang I Love Life, and they hired me, and they were going to pay me $70 a week. And I thought, wow. it was an eye-opener. You could get paid to sing and act. What could be more fun than that? And so I did not get a real job. I went into the chorus, the singing chorus of Carousel. And it's a fabulous show. It's just genius writing. And I fell in love with musical theater. That show is just, it's still my favorite.
Mm. Well, and my understanding is it was the favorite of Richard Rodgers. Of all of the wonderful scores that he composed, he regarded Carousel as his musical masterpiece. So,
well, I agree. It's just the lyrics are wonderful, and the music is soaring and wonderful. And how could you write something as beautiful as the soliloquy?
Right.
Carousel soliloquy. It's just so moving and wonderful.
I'm just curious, as a member of the chorus, you were a tenor, weren't you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you if you had Billy Bigelow envy, because, of course, you would have stood on that stage in the chorus and heard the lead of the show singing some of that magnificent music. But, of course, you yourself were a tenor, so you had different aspirations, I suppose.
Well, I stood at the side of the stage and listened to Henry Michael sing the soliloquy every show that I was in. I was in it for 3 months, and then the show left Chicago and moved on, but I had decided by that time, in fact, I had already begun, to go to Northwestern to get a master's in music and take voice lessons so that I could really develop my voice in that way.
Very good. I'm excited to be able to ask you about your vocal study at Northwestern University. Was that what we would think of as very standard kind of classical training? I mean, even though obviously your aspirations were for the musical theater world, were you studying the famous 24 Italian songs?
And absolutely. Yes, Vittoria, Vittoria was my first song.
Ah, yes.
I sang Son tutta tuolo, several of the songs in that book, and as time went on, I appreciated them more and more and more, the beauty of those songs, in addition to the vocalness of what the music says. Yes, I had a very classical training. John Toms was my voice professor, and I had a voice lesson every day for the next year and a half.
Really? You mean Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday?
Yes.
Wow. Huh.
I had told him what I wanted to do, and he said, well, let's go at it. And we did. And I did a lot of performing there at Northwestern University. I learned a lot of songs. I sang some opera, not a lot, but some. And, of course, I had to do student recitals throughout my syllabus there, and then a graduate recital, which included art songs and some opera.
Was this the first time in your life that you had sung in a foreign language?
Probably, yes. I may have in high school or college, maybe some Latin.
Mm.
But I had studied at DePauw. I had studied languages. There was a great course given studying Italian, French, and German. I had I'd taken Spanish in high school, and I'd when I was going to Northwestern, I got a job singing in a temple, so I sang in Hebrew, and suddenly I was singing in all the languages. I sang in Spanish, French, German, Italian, a lot of Italian, of course.
Huh. And evidently you were something of a natural doing all of that.
Well, I loved it. I loved singing in the other languages.
Hmm.
Adelaida, I sang on my graduate recital.
The big song, long song by Beethoven, right?
Beethoven, wonderful, wonderful song.
Amazing song. I agree.
I sang a Spanish song also in that, and an Italian song, and a French song.
Do you happen to recall, as you began studying with Mr. Toms, what his most significant reaction to your singing was? I mean, at the outset of your training with him, I mean, did he hear significant problems that needed to be fixed, or was it just a matter of this beautiful singing just sort of getting, in a sense, kind of pulled out of your body? So that whole matter of projecting and of thinking of yourself as a soloist, I mean, was that the main task at hand in this study with him?
Well, I would say yes to that, but he taught me a lot. He really taught me a lot. He taught me about opening my throat, for instance, which I hadn't thought of before. He taught me the pronunciation of vowels that could change the tone from perhaps too bright a sound that would not be in keeping with the other vowels I was singing. He had a beautiful, light, lyric, tenor voice, and he could do that so easily. It was never easy for me to do the kind of light lyric that he could do so easily.
Mm. Sometimes when people are real naturally gifted singers who just simply love to sing, it is kind of a wrenching experience emotionally and mentally, or maybe a very frustrating experience to suddenly have to kind of work at something that you always just sort of did for fun and did with a sense of ease and abandon. Do you remember as a young singer ever going through that, feeling like, I know how to sing, why do I have to go through all these voice lessons and learn all these songs in Italian, or did it seem like the most natural thing in the world for you to be suddenly studying something that you'd already been doing for so many years?
It was like eating cake. I loved it. He was a champion for me. I took a voice lesson every day, a year and a half, at which time I received a master's in music, majoring in voice. It was all choice and fun, and the learning was fun. It was never a difficulty for me. Perhaps the songs presented maybe brought out problems that he heard and that he then used as a way of teaching me something new. I loved learning new things about singing. I know what you mean, and I've heard people do that. Say, I don't want to learn to sing that way. I don't. Voice lessons are not for everybody.
Right.
I had my older brother George had a kind of a sweet tenor sound, and at DePauw he took voice lessons from a man who taught him to sing like this. He was. You got to be round. Your sound has to be round. You know, he had that overdone, awful sound. And George kept coming home and showing us how he was being asked to sing. And the rest of us in the family said, George, are you sure? Hey, you don't sound like you at all. He says, well, this is the way to do.
Ooh.
It was, you know, voice lessons. Not every voice teacher gets it.
Right. And, of course, there are certainly teachers out there that seem to want to take a singer and sort of transform them in maybe a way that is very artificial. And
yeah.
And one of the things I would say about your singing, every example of it I've ever heard is you are one of the most natural-sounding singers I can really remember listening to, in the sense that although you've had this training and know what you're doing, on the other hand, there's this wonderful sense of spontaneity and naturalness in the way that you sing. And it sounds like that was an important cornerstone of this study at Northwestern, too.
Yes, it was. I attribute a lot of that to John Toms not monkeying with my apparatus or my, you know, the way that I sang. He enlarged the sound, certainly, and he helped me to, he gave me vocal instruction that has carried me from then till now.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with a highly regarded singer by the name of Bill Hayes, and we're about to talk about some of his first experiences on television and on Broadway with Rodgers and Hammerstein. Mr. Hayes, I want to play a brief excerpt of your singing from Gilbert and Sullivan's Yeoman of the Guard. And this is a recording from a few years back, and a lovely example of your singing. I want us to hear just a little bit of this moment from Yeoman of the Guard. Again, this is with our...
1958.
What's that?
It's 1958.
Very good. So here it is, a bit of the singing of Bill Hayes.
Is life a boon? If so, it must befall that death, whene'er he call, must call too soon. Though fourscore years he give, yet one would pray to live another moon. What kind of plaint have I, who perish in July, who perish in July? I might have had to die, perchance in June. I might have had to die, perchance in June. Is life a thorn? Then count it not a whit. Nay, count it not a whit. Man is well done with it. Soon as he's born, he should all means essay to put the plague away. And I, war-worn, poor captured fugitive, my life most gladly give. I might have had to live another morn. I might have had to live, to live another morn.
That is some first-class singing. That's Bill Hayes singing "Is Life a Boon" from The Yeoman of the Guard by Gilbert and Sullivan. And Mr. Hayes, one of the things I want to say about that recording is, and one reason I played all of it, both verses, is not only is that a wonderful, brilliant, gorgeous sound, but we understand every single word. Has that clarity of diction always been a part of your singing, or did you have to work hard to develop that?
It's something that I am aware of and have worked on. When I listen to singing, I love to hear the words and understand the words. many people just make pretty sounds, but they can't understand them. I don't admire that. And I think it's very important. That's why I've tried to emphasize the consonants as much as the vowels and to make the words understandable. That recording, I've never heard that.
Really?
Never. It's I did the Yeoman of the Guard for Hallmark Hall of Fame that year, but we had an orchestra, and this one with the piano, I don't know where that came from. I've never heard that.
Wow. I purchased it from iTunes, from a double album, and I don't remember the cover, but I'll have to email you all of that information so you're aware of it. But, well, I'm glad I could give you a little surprise treat today. We need to talk about the career that took off for you on television. You proved to be quite a natural for television, and a lot of people know that you had a stint on Sid Caesar's amazing program, Your Show of Shows. I think you were actually on television just ahead of that, though. Tell us about how you first made it onto television.
My first television was in 1948, when it was still experimental, and I was working, studying at Northwestern and singing in Chicago. I sang in a jazz quintet. That was the orchestra for this the series called The Adventures of Homer Herc, H-E-R-K. And I sang duos, second tenor.
Sounds like fun.
Yes, it was fun. And in 1949, I joined Olson & Johnson. Olson & Johnson were vaudeville performers. Their biggest hit on Broadway was called Hell's a Poppin'. And it ran for many years. And we did a show. I got hired for them to do a show called Fun's a Poppin'. I had just finished at Northwestern and went on the road with them. In September 1948, Milton Berle, starting the Texaco Star Theater, really started commercial television. And when it came to the summertime of 1949, he took a 13-week hiatus, and they hired NBC, Buick, hired Olson & Johnson to do those 13 weeks, filling in for Milton Berle. So I sang mostly pop stuff on that. On that series, Max Liebman asked me to sing for him. He said, I'm putting together a show called Your Show of Shows. It's going to start next February, and I'd like for you to come sing for me. So I met him and sang one song, two different styles for him. The song was East of the Sun. I sang it as a ballad, kind of phrasing it in a pop way, and then sang it once as a rhythm song. And he hired me. So I started in February 1950 on Your Show of Shows, and I did 120 of the 160 episodes of Your Show of Shows.
Wow. You know, one of the things that's interesting to think about is now we know of this as one of the legendary programs of all time.
Yes,
so groundbreaking. I suppose at the time, none of you involved had any way of knowing what a groundbreaking program this would be. Or did you? Did you have some inkling?
We knew it was good. Sid and Imogene were just incredibly creative. We had an extremely creative cast. The writers were good. Mel Brooks being one of the writers.
Hmm.
We had Max Liebman had the idea that television was for people with money. Not everybody had a set. And the affluent people, he thought, liked sophisticated humor and more sophisticated music. So we had grand opera on every episode. We had Robert Merrill, who was a regular, and Marguerite Piazza, who was a regular. When they were not available, they brought in Jan Pierce or Patrice Bunsell or...
Lily Pons, I think, made an appearance once.
And... Yes, she was on it. Jack Russell was a baritone, and I was a tenor, and we were all-purpose. We would do a scene with Marguerite or Bob Merrill, and then they would sing the aria. So I got to sing some opera all through my time, and some demanding operetta all through my time on your show of shows.
Wow. And this is in front of an audience, right? I mean, I know the show was live, and I believe there was an audience there taking it all in. Is that right?
We had an audience of about 350. We were not in the studio. We were in a theater. It was the International Theater in New York City, and they had taken out many of the seats to put cameras in and platforms for the cameras, but they left about 350 seats, so we had a live audience, and people don't relate today to live. They just don't understand that live is live. They say, well, you pre-recorded. No, we didn't pre-record anything. We was live.
Mm.
You had to sing. It's a good thing I had studied to have a projecting sound, because the microphone might be 12 feet away.
Mm. Well, and if you're sharing the stage with someone who sings regularly on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, you're singing with singers with very, very big voices.
That's right.
Wow, what a training ground.
Yes, and oh, those two are two opera stars, Merrill and Piazza, were just fabulous.
Mm.
I mean, they sang everything. Every week, a different aria. Marguerite must have sung arias of maybe three dozen composers. Just wonderful, all different languages, and Merrill the same. Boy, they were good.
And within this, the scope of a show, these would be performances, in a sense, straight performances.
Quite.
I mean, most of us, when we look back at your show of shows, we think about the hilarious comedy, and when clips are shown, it's never of Robert Merrill singing opera.
Right.
It's of all the madcap antics. And so what you're saying is this was a true variety show that involved not just comedy, but also straight singing acts as classical as what you've just been telling us about.
That's right. And
wow.
It was done very straight. Once in a while, Imogene Coca, who had quite a voice, coloratura, would with her, we would do something that lampooned the singing. We would sing it straight, but she would make fun of it. We sang the quartet from Rigoletto.
Mm.
And Jack Russell, Adriana Knowles, and Imogene and I sang it, and we sang it quite straight. And Imogene could sing it. She could sing all the coloratura and the stratospheric notes, and she would be flirting with me or something to make it funny, you know.
Wow. Do you have a recollection of where the orchestra was? Was the orchestra in front of you down in a pit, or were they backstage, or...
Okay, picture a theater.
Mm-hmm.
We're on stage. The to my left, all the seats were taken out. Like, if I'm facing out at the theater, all the seats on my left would be taken out, and the orchestra was there. There was a slight delay, so we had to go with the conductor's arm for downbeats. He wore a white shirt and was always very visible. You could see him out of the corner of your eye, no matter where you were facing. And you didn't get the sound quite when, you know, it takes a moment.
Mm.
There's that little tiny sound delay, so we went with him.
Right. Well, it sounds like you were a natural for that, because I'm sure a lot of performers would really find it hard to adjust to that. It sounds like, and from the clips I've seen of you on television, it looks like you didn't struggle with that at all.
Nope, did not.
Hmm. those had to be glorious experiences for you. Sometimes the creation of programs like that are delicious fun for the audience, but incredibly backbreakingly hard work for everybody involved.
Which it was.
Was it fun hard work or just hard work?
It was all under pressure. You know, you have a week. They decide on Sunday what you're going to sing next Saturday. And then you have to have that arranged. Buck Warnick would stay up all night Sunday night writing vocal arrangements. And we would get them, some of them on Monday, some on Tuesday, some Wednesday. And once in a while, you know, you'd make a last-minute switch. You have to learn it. It might be a song you never heard before. And you have to stage it. And memorizing everything done by Thursday, because Friday you have to show it to the camera director. You have to sing it with the orchestra, with the music still wet on the page. And Saturday was on camera the whole day. We finished Saturday night, excuse me, and you get a good night's rest, hopefully, and they decide on Sunday what you're going to sing the next week. I mean, it was all under pressure. It was very hard work.
Wow. Did it feel like the music was as important a part of things as the comedy? Did you ever feel like you and your musical colleagues were just filler between all of the comedy that was what it was really all about? Or did you feel like it was an honored component in this program?
Well, it served its purpose. Sid and Imogene were the stars of the show. And later on, when Carl Reiner arrived, he and Sid and Imogene and Howie Morris, they were fabulously funny. So we were, in a way, the relief, the setup between. We had a few vaudeville acts that came in that served that purpose. But we were respected a lot. Mm. You know, sometimes we'd do six numbers in a show.
Wow.
That's a lot of learning. And yet it had its purpose. Mm. Judy Johnson and I must have sung 100 duets, all staged. And yet we were quite respected. The opera was so beautifully done that it was quite respected. We were filler, and yet we were substantial.
Mm. We're speaking with Bill Hayes. He's just been recounting one of the most interesting chapters in his long and brilliant career, a long stint with Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. It's not long after that. I suppose it would roughly have coincided with the ending of that show as Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca were split off into two different programs. And your next significant gig, as far as I know, is an amazing opportunity to sing the lead in yet another Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. You talked earlier about how Carousel played such an important role in you wanting to become a serious professional singer. Tell us about how the opportunity to be a star in Me and Juliet came along.
I was still on Your Show of Shows. They, Rodgers and Hammerstein, auditioned for Me and Juliet in late 1952. I decided to go audition for them, and they asked me to sing in their show, and I had to request to be out of Your Show of Shows as long as Me and Juliet ran. So that's why I didn't do all the episodes of Your Show of Shows. I was out for a while. Max Liebman very kindly allowed me to go out, and I had the experience of a lifetime.
No kidding.
Rodgers and Hammerstein musical that opened at the Hanna Theater in Cleveland, ran a couple of weeks, then went to the Schubert Theater in Boston, ran 2-3 weeks, and then went to Broadway, the Majestic Theater, and we ran 11 months on Broadway.
When...
And then two more months we did in Chicago, but did not do a tour more than that.
Hmm. Your audition, was it for Mr. Rodgers and Mr. Hammerstein?
Yes, it was.
What in the world did it... I mean, you were by that point, of course, a very successful singer. Nevertheless, I can't imagine what it would be like to walk onto a stage or into a room or wherever it was and audition for two legends like Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Right, and the director was George Abbott, who was... He was the king of directors of Broadway. The three of them were sitting there, and I couldn't help but see them. I sang a song from Miss Liberty called I Love You. It's by Irving Berlin, and I sang it in E-flat, so it opened on a high G. And, excuse me, just 1 second.
That's
please.
Fine.
818. Hello? Oh.
Okay, all right. Sorry, I'm back.
That's all right.
I wanted them to know that I had high notes, so I opened with a song that started on a G, and I love you, there's no other way, just one way to say I love you. And they liked me and hired me, and then I opened on Broadway.
Wow.
Played on Broadway.
What did it feel like to be shifting from what you had done on your show of shows, which was a different little adventure every single week, to something like this, which was one huge project? And you worked, I assume, for weeks, maybe months, I assume months, before this big project opened. I mean, I should think that felt very different in some ways. Was it difficult to work in that kind of way?
It was different, yes. We had 5 weeks of rehearsal before we opened at the Hanna Theater in Cleveland, and then they made changes. So you might come in the next day and say, "Well, we're doing this. Here are your new pages for that scene, and that scene is out, and that here's," and we fixed and changed. There was a song in Me and Juliet that Joe Lautner sang, called "The Big Black Giant." He had a beautiful bass voice. And they ended up, after the run in Cleveland, and said, it's not right for him to sing that song. Bill Hayes should sing that song. So suddenly they did an arrangement in E-flat, and I sang The Big Black Giant. But it was, you're right, we had more rehearsal time. But it was still, with all the changes... You had to be malleable.
Of course. It's like you never knew what would be coming next in some respects.
Once we opened, they didn't change a thing. Once we opened on Broadway, that was it. That was the show. And Dick Rodgers was a stickler. No phrasing. No other love have I, 2, 3, 4, hold right to the end and then grab a quick breath. The only my love for you, all the eighth notes, anticipating the bar lines and everything, he wanted it sung that way. He said, you go in a club or record it, you can sing it any way you want, but on this stage, it's my show, and you do it the way I wrote it. That's it.
Wow. And, I assume back then, although I could be wrong, that you had nothing like the amplification that now you have all the time on Broadway. Was there some amplification of the voices, or mostly was it just your voices needing to project into the hall on their own?
Zip. No amplification. We sang in stagey keys, therefore. I mean, if you were going to sing it in the best key for your voice, you might choose one key, but for the stage, it had to project, and so they sang it a little bit higher and a little more demandingly. Mm. We sang No Other Love in A-flat, and it ends with an A-flat.
Mm.
I'm one up there.
the excerpt from Me and Juliet that I have actually queued up is actually a fun moment from the show called That's the Way It Happens, which is, I think, one of the duets that you sing, right?
Yes, I sang it first as almost like an opening number in the show. I sang it first, and then Isabel Bigley sang a chorus of it.
Here is a little bit of that fun song again. This is Bill Hayes in Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet from the original Broadway cast recording.
You're a guy in New Haven on the road with a show. There's a girl in the company that you hardly know. You watch her and you wonder if she'd like to partake of French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. Then along comes a fellow who is quicker than you, and he does what you thought that you would like to do. He takes her to a bistro where they give you a break with French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. Now you see them together and you know in your heart that you lost what you wanted at the very start, because you didn't ask her if she'd like to partake of French fried potatoes and a T-bone steak. That's the way it happens. That's the way it happens. That's the way it happened to me.
There it is, a moment from Me and Juliet by Rodgers and Hammerstein, sung by Bill Hayes. What were Rodgers and Hammerstein like to work with in this show? You've already told us about Mr. Rodgers being very exacting and precise. Were they supportive directors, or intimidating, or a little of both?
Both of them were so professional and so supportive. I worked with Dick Rodgers in years after, where he was a conductor, and he knew the music, and he was an excellent conductor. He heard everything. If someone played a sixth and there wasn't a sixth in the chord, he knew it, and he knew who played it.
Wow.
Oscar Hammerstein was of course involved with the words. If I can remember George Abbott staging a scene and it being rather confusing to Isabel Bigley and me. And after the scene was all done and we went to work on something else, Oscar came up and said, well, think of it this way. So he saw that we were struggling with something, and he came and put it straight. They were both very helpful. I am such an admirer of both of them. I did a show of Rodgers and Hart music. We sang Gogie Grant, and I sang like 52-54 songs of Rodgers and Hart. And Rodgers is so creative in all those Rodgers and Hart songs. And then he changed his style, and when the words came from Oscar Hammerstein, his music changed. He went with the heart of Oscar Hammerstein. He's such a creative fellow. And then Hammerstein, I loved what he did. The man is a great man.
Mm. Well, what a thrill for you to be a part of a Broadway history as one of the leads in this really intriguing show. Not in their top five or six in terms of highest grossing shows, but a commendable part of their legacy, and there you were at the heart of it. The thrill of a lifetime.
Well, you're right. Thrill of a lifetime.
Entertainer Bill Hayes. On Monday, we will continue this conversation, and at some point during it, he will be joined by his wife, the lovely actress Susan Seaforth Hayes. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org.